Hello, this is John Riolo. Welcome to the Insider Internet Radio Show, where we look at mental health treatment from the viewpoint of both consumers and practitioners. See my websites. We have several these days, so let me just give my latest. They are all linked together anyway. My latest is the Insider's Guide to Lore and Ethics in Mental Health. That's http://insiderlawetics.com. My guest today is Dr. Ofer Zur. Dr. Zur is the author of the HIPAA Compliance Kit, which we'll be discussing today, and his latest book, Boundaries in Psychotherapy, Ethical and Clinical Explorations. Hopefully we'll get to talk about that with him at a later point in time and maybe even bring a little bit of it in today. Dr. Zur is a consultant, licensed psychologist, writer, forensic consultant, and lecturer from Sonoma, California. He's a pioneer in the development of the ethical and effective managed care free practice and is a prolific writer and researcher. Dr. Zur taught for many years at several graduate schools in the San Francisco area, as well as teaching the preparatory courses for licensing exams in California. He has trained thousands of psychotherapists in his seminars, lectures, and private consultations on how to successfully build an ethical, effective, and thriving private practice. In 2003, he published the HIPAA Compliance Kit, distributed by Norton & Company. That's the book we'll be discussing today. However, again, I would be remiss if I didn't mention his latest book, Boundaries and in Psychotherapy, Ethical and Clinical Explorations. This is to be published by APA Books. This book discusses issues such as touch, self-disclosure, gifts, bartering, telehealth, dual relationships, and many of the issues that I've been interested in writing about. So we have some common interests, and in many places we agree, maybe some places we don't. But hopefully we'll discuss that. But first, HIPAA. Welcome, Dr. Zur.
Thank you, John. Happy to be discussing HIPAA with you today.
Okay. Well, you have a very succinct little book about HIPAA that covers some of the major issues that I read. When I first read it, I said, wow, this really answers some of my questions, and then I reread it again just before this interview, and I got to say I'm impressed. It has not only answers to some questions, it comes with a CD with downloadable forms, checklists, etc. For a small book, I would say small in terms of it's not one of those huge tomes that you'll break your back carrying around, it packs a lot of information. So what made you decide to, you know, cover this and tell us a little generally about your thoughts on putting this book together?
When in 2002, when I saw HIPAA coming around the corner and me teaching ethics classes, I start trying to figure out what this HIPAA animal is about. And I found out that I couldn't understand the 2 million pages regulations, and I couldn't understand what their attorneys explaining to us about HIPAA. I couldn't understand what the professional organization telling us about HIPAA. So I decided to translate all this legalese and all this jargon and all this wording that means nothing to psychologists, social workers, counselors, people who really do the practice and the regulations are aimed at them, to translate it to simple, understandable form of understanding the regulation. So I wrote this book in the form of a set of a couple of hundred questions and a simple, sometimes two sentences answer to each of these questions that we'll attend to today. The idea is to make it simple, understandable, and usable and applicable.
Well, that's certainly something that would have been surely needed. I've many times said to colleagues I have a HIPAA headache just trying to understand the questions, let alone the answers to some of the issues embedded in HIPAA. It's just so mind-boggling. Without giving away your entire book, which hopefully people will go to your website and purchase, let me ask a couple of questions that might relate to things that practitioners as well as consumers may want to know about. One question I have, and you know, recently I was listening, actually reading, because it was on the internet, to some colleagues discussing how they have worked very hard not to be covered entities. They've advised others what to do not to be a covered entity. Are there any advantages these days to not being a covered entity under HIPAA?
It's that's kind of definitely the million-dollar question of HIPAA. Am I a covered entity? With psychotherapists, with a social worker, psychologists, counselors, MFTs, each person asking himself or herself. My answer for that is that even if you live in a tent and you see people on the reservation, you don't have electricity and you don't have computer, you still need to be compliant with HIPAA. The answer for that is that HIPAA, not from the technical limited view of the law, is not about electronic transmissions, it's not about electronic storage, it's about the standard of care. I usually do not agree with the American Psychological Association, but they were right on with understanding that back in 2003, they recommended that all psychologists will become compliant because the issue of HIPAA will be determined in through case law, through the courts, when people who even do not own a computer suddenly turn to be a covered entity or did not comply with what is becoming the standard of care.
Now,
and I can talk about the reason to become HIPAA compliant beyond the issue of standard of care, but this is the most important one. And the second one that I mentioned, that you may be the subject of case law that will determine that you should have been compliant, but it would be too late. Would you like me to go into some of the other issues that may lead people to become covered entity without them knowing or even expecting it?
Please, because I think that's very important. Again, because some of my colleagues believe, and they, whether they're right or wrong, I mean, my head, I just give up trying to figure it out, that as long as they don't send a bill electronically, they could, in essence, forget about HIPAA, or they're not a covered entity. I mean, forgetting about it is too strong a term. And I guess my concern is some of the energy that they put into trying so hard not to be a covered entity seems to be misplaced. So if you could address that question, I think it might fit in very well to the issue, the concern that I had.
So again, the first two most important reasons to become compliant will be that HIPAA is becoming the standard of care set up by the federal government. The second one is that who should be covered, who shouldn't be covered, will ultimately determine by case law, and I don't want any of your listeners to be one of these case laws. But for example, one of your clients had a manic episode and end up in a prison in Vermont or in a mental hospital. They ask you to transmit the record. The person signed a consent and they ask you to transmit the record. You're not going to send it overnight express. The guy is in the midst of a manic episode or psychotic episode. They want to know what's the medication, and they want you to send it via email attachment, or via fax. If you must comply with this request for the records, or at least for summary of the records, or at least to let them know what diagnosis and medication and who is a treating psychiatrist, regardless of your license, and you send it to them via email, and here you are already transmitting information via the internet, and you are covered under the most restricted guidelines, you become a covered entity. You didn't have control over that, it just happened to you.
So it only takes one time.
It will take one time. And by that time, they don't give you leeway, or you have 30 days to be compliant. The moment you push the button of the email giving this information to a mental state hospital in Vermont, you should be covered entity. And you won't unless you are prepared, because it may take a couple of hours to become compliant, as I'll explain later on. It does not take a month. It doesn't take a year of your life.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't take even a day of your life if you are informed. An hour after this, listening to this interview, you can be compliant, literally within an hour. So, for example, some people say, "Oh, I don't transmit electronically, but I transmit it only via fax because HIPAA said that fax does not constitute
I've heard that.
Transmission." This is another myth, because if your fax is being received on the other end, not by a standalone fax machine, but by a fax modem, this is becoming electronic transmission, and you don't even know about it.
Fascinating.
So you can be, now, for example, you work with somebody who does your billing, and this person promises you that they are only using donkeys and camels to transmit, to send you bills, whatever, snail mail, snails, they're using snails. Suddenly, they are converting to computers, because as we know, Medicare, Medicaid soon or already do not accept a hard copy billing. So they convert to electronic billings, and you are a covered entity, and you don't even know about it. So and the most important part, all these people who are fighting HIPAA, they are often ignorant about HIPAA, because HIPAA it's not a bad rules, and you can hear it from somebody who doesn't really like necessarily or obediently obey all rules.
Well, I can attest to that in terms of some of your other stuff.
You will testify to that, no doubt, because we had our respectful dialogue on this issue.
That's
but
true.
It's good stuff. It help you organize your practice. It update your clinical forms. It gives authorizations that are more respectful to clients, and ultimately protect both you and the client. It's not really listening, hearing it from me, that it's not a bad law should count to something. So in short, there are many reasons to become HIPAA compliant, from just improving your practice to the whole issue that it is becoming the standard of care. This was a carrot. The stick on the other part is that non-compliance can be very costly.
But so
if you, at the end of this pod that you are listening to, you go and you do two forms of the checklist, the HIPAA checklist that is one of the forms on my CD, and the HIPAA Notice of Privacy Practices, you probably by now 80% compliance. If you have not done other things and the Fed's coming after you, but they see that you have these two forms, they will be educational with you. They will work with you. They will not penalize you. They're not likely to arrest you. They won't do anything. They'll see that you gave it a try, but now they have to teach you how to do it even better. But this is different if you are criminally neglecting complying with HIPAA and you ignoring HIPAA. In this case, they are less likely to be educational. So we need to understand that the HIPAA, the authorities, the feds, are not going after you. They don't have investigation that fishing for information like so many of our boards. They are going only to respond so far to complaints.
Well, you know, you brought up something, though, that I just want to come back to, because I really think it struck me very clearly as you talked about it. I had heard about the facts. And for myself, I knew I was a covered entity because for years, my fax machine is run through my computer. So I knew right away.
Absolutely.
However, if I understand you correctly, a colleague of mine who were to send me a record, they're using the same old fax machine. By the very fact that they sent it to me, which runs through my computer.
Yes.
They're a covered entity, and they don't know it.
You got it. You really got it. And I don't say to scare people. I would say that complying with HIPAA will just make your practice better. It will take, as I said, an hour once you got the information, and you have a better release of information forms. You will have better information to clients about the limitation of confidentiality, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Now, that is important information. I wasn't aware of that. I mean, I knew I was HIPAA entity, again, because I have my my fax machine runs to break for many other reasons as well. But anybody who does business with me, sends me any information, they're covered entity by the very fact that information runs through my computer.
Yes.
Well, the
now it's being stored and received in electronic form.
Okay. Now, I wonder if we can, because there's so many things I'd like to cover, and there's so many things in that little book of yours that's helpful. I want to get to some of the main points. One of the things that I think is important, and I discussed this at some length with my colleague Laura Groshon and David Schoolcraft, the attorney for the Clinical Social Work Association, but it's important enough that I wanted to get a slightly different opinion on it or concur a bit. The idea about separate records and note keeping. Under HIPAA, if I understand it correctly, one doesn't have to, but one can keep two different, you know, sets of records, so to speak. And the particular point of information that I'm referring to is the psychotherapy notes. Can you touch upon that a bit?
Absolutely. This is another source of huge confusion. And I have on my website at www.drzur.com, I have a whole write-up about keeping two sets of records. Again, it's www.drzur.com. There's some free articles about HIPAA, so people can find it there. The idea about two sets of records is that it's allowable, first of all, it's not mandated. This is the first thing that everybody needs to understand. You do not need to keep two sets of records. The definition of what belongs in the psychotherapy notes, which is a new HIPAA invention, rather than what is belong with the general medical records, is very, very confusing. It was written by somebody who has never knew how to spell psychotherapy. And my recommendation is just forget about keeping two sets of records. The problem, if you're going to keep this more private set of records, you need to label it a certain way. If it ever being sent anywhere without the right authorization, it can get you into huge trouble. Why do anybody need to remember what goes what? Don't we have enough trouble in keeping one set of record? I do. I've been teaching this topic for over 20 years, and I know that clinicians struggle all the time with keeping one set of records. Forget about the two sets of records. Keep one set of records. There is no reason for anybody to know about your countertransference reaction. Don't put in the regular record what is shaming, what is not highly clinical relevant, or what can be harming to the client if it's not highly clinical relevant. Keep good, solid records with good treatment plan. You do not need to keep two sets of records because, for example, let's say that you keep the second set of records where you keep all the super private information about your reaction to the clients, about what the client told you, and the client sign a release and telling you, please send this set of supposedly more private psychotherapy notes to another clinician. At this point, you have to comply.
Let me just double, you have to. I want to make sure I understand that right. I'm a client. I sign a release to you saying send the whole nine yards.
Including
the psychotherapy notes.
You must comply
okay.
with that. Unless you can say for some reason it may hurt the client and you make an argument, but then if the client asks you to send it to another psychotherapist, you have to do it.
It's a pretty tough argument to make, or to an attorney, perhaps.
It would be impossible because the other psychotherapist, licensed psychology, social worker, counselor, should be able to protect the client as well as you are. It will not an argument; it will hold anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
So you lose all control. For example, right now we don't have case law that determine whether psychotherapy notes are subpoenaable or not by the courts. we know that we're not going to give it to the other attorney on the other side in some kind of legal dispute. But what happened is you have a fantastic pod on issues of subpoenas too. And but if the judge insists that you release the psychotherapy notes, and the judge can tell you that you even go to jail, or mm-hmm. the judge can tell you whatever they want. He can got, he can get your birth certificate, he can get your AIDS test, whatever the judge can subpoena anything that they choose to. So why ever write something that will make you and your client vulnerable, while it's hard enough to keep one set of notation? I didn't even get into what is the second set of psychotherapy notes. I can get into that, but perhaps if we have in the short time we have, the message is become compliant. So far, the message is become compliant even if you don't own a computer. Don't keep two sets of records. It's not worth the trouble. This is the two messages so far. I'm summarizing it halfway.
Mm-hmm. Nope. Right. Very good.
Now the question is, once I say that, is so what should I do to become compliant? I told you, audience, that they can get it, can become compliant very fast. And do you want me to get into that?
That, I think that would be good. Then I have a couple of the questions here, but let's say how you said that. Let's say I'm not compliant. You said I could become compliant probably by the end of the day after this phone call. What do I need to do?
What do you need to do? You, besides getting informed, that means you need to understand what this HIPAA is about, and there's online courses, there are books, there are booklets, just don't read anything in legalese, get informed. Then what you need to do is to get some very, very basic forms in place. The first is the HIPAA-compliant checklist. That means it's a list of that you listen to this podcast, that you have the forms. How do you protect your computer? Everybody has firewall. I haven't seen anybody without firewall, without virus protection. If you don't have a password, add a password, and from there on you are ready. 80% compliance with HIPAA regarding your computer.
Yeah,
so all this information goes into the HIPAA compliant checklist. How do you lock your file cabinets, the hard copy forms, so the janitor and other clinicians who work out of your office cannot access them? Simple things like that. How do you back your computer up? So all this goes there. Then once you have this is a checklist for yourself that you keep in your HIPAA folder. The second thing that you need to have is a notice of privacy practices. This is a notice of privacy practices that all of us as consumers sign up in 2003 when we saw our chiropractors, our medical doctor, our optometrist, our dentist. We sign this form everywhere. For some reason, 80% of clinicians or 85 at a time chose not to be compliant just because we don't know how to do change very well. So get this notice of privacy practices. This has to be state specific. That means the notice of privacy practices is an analysis of relationship between state law and federal law, the HIPAA federal law. Get it from your own organization, your own professional state professional organization, or I have mine on the CD that apply to most states that you can tweak and make mm-hmm. it applicable to you. So once you got these two things, the HIPAA compliant checklist for yourself that shows how you keep your information private, and there'd be very little new things there for you. We as psychotherapists do not need to do much to become compliant because we are so focused on issues of privacy and confidentiality, much more than almost any other medical profession. That means we are already 90% HIPAA compliant just because our focus on privacy and confidentiality that is traditional has been part of our discipline. So if you have the HIPAA compliant checklist where you determine all the ways that you protect privacy and confidentiality in your office, in your operation, and you give each client the notice of privacy practices, you are already ahead of the game. Later on, you may need to have new forms of disclosure. You have to have the authorization to disclose and how to amend health information. There'll be probably four or five more forms that you'll need. But these two forms already will show the Fed, if you're ever being audited or investigated, that you care about HIPAA. You did the two most important things. And they will work with you to complete your compliance if you need to. They wouldn't like to see that you didn't do these two forms. How long it will take to get these two forms? They are on my CD. It took some people 15 minutes.
Now, let me just make a question and a comment about your CD. I've looked at your forms on the CD, and I think they're first rate. I mean, I got compliant years ago, and if I had a form like that, it would have been quite a bit easier than because we were struggling at the time in the very beginning. But now the forms on your CD, they're copyrighted, right? People can, when they buy your book, they get those forms off the CD, they're for their own personal and practice use, correct?
Absolutely. They put your name and address at the top as a letterhead, and off you go. Some of them need to be, as I say, adjusted to state law, and generally very minimal. And you are ready to go. As I say, some people that use my forms put it to action within 15 minutes. What's the big deal? You slap your letterhead on top of the form, and you make sure that the rules are compliant with your state.
But we're not suggesting, you're not suggesting that somebody buy your book, they could take your forms and then post it to an internet discussion group so 100 or 800 or 1,000 other people can get their hands on it.
Oh, no, you'll get my wrath for that.
Well, I emphasize that because one of my other projects is my intellectual property series. And as a profession, you know, we talk about privacy a great deal. But some of us really need to take a look at how well we respect the intellectual property of our colleagues.
Thank you for saying
that. So I want to make that point clear. This is, you buy it, it's for you, not 1,000 of your friends on the internet. Let them go out and buy the book or not, as the case may be.
It's thank you. So again, it's part of the standard of care. It's very doable. Don't complicate your life by having two sets of forms. Perhaps we mentioned computer, it's worth perhaps a minute of our time. What does it take to become HIPAA compliant in regard to computer? Very simple, you're probably already there. You need to have a firewall. I don't know anyone without a firewall, anybody that spent time on the internet. It comes just with a computer, I think. Yeah.
Windows has one built in.
Norton
antivirus does.
So everything is built in for us already. So firewall. Then you have a virus protection. Who doesn't? And you need to have a password that you change regularly. You need to have in the log that I mentioned before, the HIPAA, the checklist, you need to see who have access to the computer, how often do you change the password, big deal, very little deal, and then you need to have backups. HIPAA does not tell us how to do the firewalls, how to do the password. HIPAA is technologically neutral. There is a big question about encryption. It has not been resolved, so there is no standard of encryption for us to follow. What I do in my emails, I have a very long disclaimer that I'd be more than happy to share with you, with people, that information that's being transmitted via email is very vulnerable to intrusion, to people who are not authorized, because each email that we send reside on my computer, your computer, and our two servers, and who knows where else. So it's very vulnerable. I have a statement in every email signature that I send to clients and they can tell me if they don't want to communicate via email. Of course, 99% of them find email a very acceptable way to communicate.
Inconvenient.
The last thing that I need to mention about computers is a backup. HIPAA doesn't tell us how to backup. My personal recommendation is to have off-site backup and offline. In my case, I'll back it up into a CD and store it off-site. So, but HIPAA doesn't mandate it. It's just my little common sense. Off-site and online, there's a way to back it up online. HIPAA will not frown upon it. They just want to see that you've done your best and you're a reasonable practitioner.
And again, it is common sense. I mean, having had a computer crash or two a couple of times, if I didn't have my information for my practice or anything else backed up or on another working computer that I could get my hands on, I'd be out of business.
This is a common sense. This is what I say. HIPAA will improve. If you don't have a backup, HIPAA will remind you that a backup is a good idea. I'm not sure how much time we have. I would like to discuss what are some of the new things that HIPAA introduced that we never had before.
Okay. Well, we've had as much time as at this point. We're just in terms of how long these podcasts are generally useful, we should probably begin to think winding down. I'd like to get to your question, but I wonder if I could interject one more, and then we can give you the kind of the wrap-up. You talked about encryption in email. One of the things, and I don't know if it's HIPAA-related, common sense-related, or I wonder if your comment can be on it, one of the things that's happening with increasing frequency that I've been concerned about is that clinicians have gone to the Internet, to Internet discussion groups for consultation. They discuss, sometimes they discuss patients sometimes in great detail, in groups of anywhere from 200 to 1,000 other clinicians, cases. Any thoughts on this, either as it relates to HIPAA or just the usefulness of these kinds of discussions?
It's not a directly HIPAA question, and it's an issue of confidentiality. I think that if people disguise enough and change from a man to a woman, instead of 20 years old, it's 65 years old, then if a small town is it's a big metropolitan, if they disguise the identity of the client, there's a fantastic venue to discuss clients. If you talk about the generic case rather than
the specific.
A specific case, they talk about the principle. I mean, this chat rooms and listservs can be fantastic tool. It has just need to be done like any other confidential consultation. I consult on ethical issues all the time with people, and they give me the gist of the generic problem so I can respond to. I don't need to get the name and address and age or gender even. So use a discussion group intelligently. Anybody who says never use a discussion group is an idiot, because it's a fantastic venue to discuss ethical, clinical, and potentially legal issues using a lot of clinicians. Be smart about it. Be very confidential. Just talk about the generic and essential, the heart of the matter. Did I answer your question?
Yeah, we agree. I guess what I'm saying is it's certainly for a generic type situation, it can be tremendously useful. It gets tricky if you're asking for specific advice on a specific individual, because if you disguise as well as you described, you're talking about a totally different case, and the information you get may not be helpful to you.
That's very true. If you disguise it far enough, you may not have the specific, but this is something you have to do. You must disguise it in a way that it's not identifiable. Absolutely, unless you get permission from the client. This is not a directly HIPAA question, but it's a very good question.
Okay. With the few minutes we have left, let me throw it open to you to cover any question I should have asked or you just didn't have time to ask before. Why don't we just...
A few things that HIPAA introduced that haven't been in any state law before around psychotherapy or most states, that HIPAA right now have the right not only to read the records, HIPAA gave clients the right to amend the records. The right to request to amend the records. If you deny the request to amend the record. That means if you see a psychotherapist and give a diagnosis of drug addiction and you say, oh no, you have the right to request an amend of records, clinicians either comply with that or they deny it and need to explain it. HIPAA said that when you talk to a psychiatrist about your client, you just need to talk about what's highly relevant to the psychiatrist's medication evaluation. You don't need to talk about child abuse. HIPAA introduced a new term of business associate that you need to pay attention. Many therapists do not have business associates like a biller and stuff like that. And HIPAA also says that something that we always used before, but now it's become a law, that you need to share with people on staff only what they need to know. It's called the need-to-know requirement. We have probably complied with that, but now it's a law that people on staff that do not need to know the diagnosis or the treatment shouldn't know if they only need to know what the billing is, for example. So HIPAA introduced some few very good ideas about how to run a practice. It's very doable, and it will make you a better practitioner and a better manager of your office. So I think we can wrap it up.
I think so. You've really covered a great deal of material. Your book can be purchased where again? At your website?
My website at www.drzur.com, spells drzur.com.
And if you have a comment, any of our listeners have a comment that they would like to pass on to Dr. Zur, they could have a couple ways of doing it. They could probably contact him directly on his website, or they could send the message through me at johnr@psychjourney.com, and I'll see that he gets it. Or we have a feature where you can leave a voicemail message for any of our guests, and that would be calling in 214, that's the area code, 615-6044, and extension 8460. But please remember, long-distance rates could apply with that phone call, and you can leave a voice message for either myself or Dr. Zur.
You know, one more thing I mentioned is that actually you can get the entire booklet online if you sign for the online course.
Okay, that would be something that, you know, people can do. Certainly, look, I've read Dr. Zur's book now twice now, once when I first got it and again in preparing for this interview. And for a small book that will not, break your arm carrying around, it packs a fantastic amount of information. So I don't recommend every book I interview to the same degree, but this one is one that I would recommend every clinician to have, and even consumers to at least acquaint themselves as to what their rights are. So again, I thank you again, Dr. Zur, and I hope we can have you back to discuss your latest book when the time comes.
And happy to come back, and really thank John for all your really thoughtful and cutting-edge work that you have been doing, pulling so many resources, and even when we disagree, it has been fun to disagree with you because you are so respectful.
Well, thank you. And what I find, I always learn more from people who I don't fully agree with. It's tiresome to have people, well, fortunately, not that many in my who agree with me all the time. But it does get tiresome if everybody's just agreeing with you. It's the people who challenge you that I find to be the most productive to communicate with.
You have been very honoring, and it has become a creative process, this kind of respectful dialogue.
Okay, well, thank you again, and this is John Riolo, the Insider. Until next time.